Because what did those kids learn? They learned that anybody can leave you for any reason, at any time. You'll never see it coming, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Dear Jane Time, once again, I'm Scott, she's Marcy. How you doing?
Great.
What's the difference when you think about, maybe you wouldn't identify a difference between pro-life and pro-child? You're both automatically, you would think, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, I want the child to live, and then I want the child to thrive.
Turns out there's a kind of a big difference, actually. Mm-hmm. We're going to learn about it today with Katie Faust from Them Before Us. Very, very passionate speaker on a host of issues and basically just talking about the importance of, this isn't a dated term, but like the nuclear family, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Importance of both mother and father. Thinking, kind of challenging some of our even conservative, maybe Christian ways of thinking about family and what's best for children.
We love people coming on this podcast and sort of making us revisit and rethink some of this stuff. Hey, before we get to Katie, make sure you subscribe, tell your friends, leave the comments, all the stuff. We're having a great time. We're having great conversations. Make sure people, all your friends, maybe even friends that aren't traditional, in-your-face, pro-life people, I think they might appreciate the conversations we have here, so make sure you do that. Katie Faust, the founder and president of Them Before Us, joins us today on Dear Jane.
Katie, thanks so much for joining us on Dear Jane today.
It's really good to be with you.
It's crazy. Maybe seems crazy to some people that an organization has to exist that needs to insist that children's natural rights not be subject to adult desires. But probably a lot of well-meaning people don't even realize how much culture has shifted in this direction. So can you give us some examples of even how in Christian communities we put adult desires ahead of children's rights?
It's very hard to find an example of an overall like demographic or topic where children's rights and needs are being put first. Whether you are looking at kind of cultural changes, legal changes, technological changes, whether you're looking at, you know, the people that identify as gay or even the people that identify as, you know, heterosexual, Christian or secular, there's no real place where you can say, okay, they're consistently putting kids first. And obviously, I think that the motivations of a lot of the people sometimes might even be, well, this is good for the kid. Maybe they'll even think that. But it's not. I mean, there's really very few areas where I can say these people are getting it right. I will say that the pro-life movement, when it's done properly, is one of the best examples of that. And I think that we have seen advances in retaking lost ground on the abortion issue because we have had pro-life organizations that have said, we are going to unflinchingly defend children's right to life from the moment of conception. We are going to humanize them. We are going to protect them. We're going to give an articulate defense. We're going to be able to respond to the different common rebuttals to our position, and we're not going to move one inch. And to me, that is a compelling stance that opens eyes, that brings people around to your position. Now, not all, you know, anti-abortion voices do that well, I think. But to me, that is a good example of putting children first. There are so many areas where we do not do that. And I think that even the Christian church has failed in that area. And then I think pro-lifers have a ways to go on some other areas that deal directly with children's rights. So the issues that we deal with at Them Before Us are things like the definition of marriage and divorce and modern families and reproductive technologies like IVF and sperm and egg donation and surrogacy and even adoption. And I can tell you that on all of those areas, they are overwhelmingly shaped by the desires, feelings, identities, longings, or losses of adults. And it is the children who suffer when we get those questions wrong.
So give us a little background on Them Before Us. I mean, just in terms of what where do you intersect with what people might think of as the traditional pro-life movement?
I didn't get into this primarily as somebody that was advocating for children's right to life. I looked across the landscape of the United States and I was like, wow, looks like there is, as far as I can tell, at least 100 pro-life organizations and certainly pro-life platforms that are advocating for children's right to life from the moment of conception, especially as it relates to abortion. I got into this because I wanted to defend children's rights to their mother and father. And nobody was doing that. You know, when the gay marriage argument came on the scene, that conversation either from the left focused on adult identity and validation, or from the right, they made it a religious liberties argument, right? We need to keep traditional marriage because otherwise you'll have to bake a cake you don't want to bake. And I was like, hold on there. Children have a right to their mother and father. And securing that right is actually the greatest portal for child thriving that any society throughout history has ever discovered. And it's not even close. And so I just found that children's perspectives were not being represented in those conversations. And then the more I got into it, the more I realized these kids' perspective isn't being represented anywhere, not just on whether or not we should legalize gay marriage, but on questions of divorce. And then, you know, whether or not we promote open non-monogamy or, you know, even like who has a right to adopt a child. And then the modern family question took me into the world of reproductive technologies, where it was very clear that a huge percentage of children were losing their right to be known and loved by their mother and father through using a third party, somebody else's sperm or somebody else's egg or somebody else's womb, to create a child that very often would lose a relationship with one or both of their biological parents. So I got into this reproductive technology side of the debate specifically because it threatened children's rights to their mother and father. But come to find out that if you believe children have a right to life from the moment of conception, big fertility is a bigger victimizer of children's right to life than Planned Parenthood is. So now we probably last year, I think we probably did more interviews on defending children's right to life from IVF than we did on any other topic. So we came into the intersection of children's, defending children's right to life, not because I don't believe it. I just thought we've got this covered, but we don't as it relates to, you know, I think we've got it covered in the sense of fighting the baby taking industry. But when it comes to fighting the baby making industry and how that victimizes children, there was nobody, virtually nobody talking about that.
And I know we want to talk about IVF. I know Marcy gets fired up about it. And I know you do too. But before we get there, you know, it's funny. I'm thinking of maybe some of your internal planning meetings or maybe feedback you get from the outside. And you would have this voice to say, okay, well, let's focus on a child's right to their mother and father. Oh, but you're going to exclude the single parent families. So we can't do that. Have you ever had to wrestle with that?
Well, Scott. Well,
he tells me yes.
I actually often start interviews by saying, give me enough time and I will trigger you too. Because they're in this world of putting children first, believing that they have a right to life and believing they have a right to their mother and father. At some point, those two realities will run up against your self-interest. Those things are in direct competition with one another. Either children have a right to life and a right to their mother and father, or you can have what you want. You have to choose. And the problem is that because children cannot advocate for themselves, they don't hire lawyers, they can't blog, they don't do interviews on podcast platforms, the adults get what they want. The children have to stick it. The children have to deal with whatever the adults decide. And so what we are going to do, if I do my job in this interview, I will represent the rights of children as if they were sitting here on this podcast. I will advocate for their interests. And it will mean that some adult in the audience will be like, but that means I can't have what I want. And the answer is correct. Somebody will do the hard thing in that equation. Either the adults will do hard things and force children to sacrifice for them, or the adults, sorry, either, I don't know if you can edit, you can edit, but, or I'll just try to say this again. Either the child will do the hard thing by losing their right to life and their right to their mother and father, or the adults will do hard things by conforming their lives to protect the child's right to life or the right to their mother and father. So do you see there that in those situations where there's an unplanned pregnancy or infertility or a marriage that's in crisis or somebody that experiences same-sex attraction, somebody's going to do the hard thing. It's not like nobody does the hard thing. Either the adults will or the child will, and in a just society, it is the adults who do hard things on behalf of children. But in our society, according to the culture, law, and technology we currently have today around family formation, it is the kids who are doing the hard thing. And that is why we are seeing such widespread injustice on behalf of children.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about, I know Scott got his question in because he knows exactly where I want to go, and that's to jump into the IVF conversation. And I want to, it's so sensitive, obviously, because so many people are involved in IVF now or have been touched by it in some way. But I think a lot of times even Christian couples think, okay, children are a blessing from the Lord. God talks about how great children are. You know, the family is supposed to be the bedrock of society and culture. And so we're doing a good thing by engaging in IVF to bring children into our family. How could that be an example of adults still putting themselves before kids?
This is an area where I think that the Christian community is very susceptible to victimizing children, unfortunately. And it is because, for all the reasons that you just said, wanting to be a parent is good. Longing for children is God-given. And yet, our primary job as Christians is not to validate adults or empathize with adults or give adults what they want. Child protection is and always has been a manifestation of the pure and undefiled religion before God that God explicitly laid out in James for us. We, as Christians, follow a God who was the strongest of all, who came down to sacrifice for the weakest among us, while we were yet sinners. He died for us. And then God tells us to go and do likewise. God is very explicit about the punishment should any of us cause one of these little ones to stumble. When you look back at Christians throughout history, whether it was the pagan world into which Christianity was born, whether it's missionary travails kind of out into places that didn't have any kind of a Christian worldview, what you see is everywhere that Christianity goes, the rights and well-being of children are elevated. And so Christians have primarily been, by the nature of the Christian worldview, responsible for humanizing and protecting children everywhere across the world. Child protection is part and parcel of a genuine Christian life. That is probably one of the central aspects of what it looks like to live out your faith with conviction. So I say that because in the world of reproductive technologies, it is very easy for us to say, yes, but this is what the adults want. I understand it's what they want. That cannot be fulfilled in a way that victimizes children. And there's two primary ways that children are victimized when couples that are struggling to have children walk into a fertility clinic. The first way that children are victimized is overwhelmingly those children will lose their right to life. Overwhelmingly. Yeah. What we are seeing, and now, when I'm going to give you some numbers, and it is the best that I can do to piece these numbers together, because unlike organ donations and even unlike abortions, there is no requirement for fertility clinics to track and share what they do with these little lab-created lives. But by our best estimates, a safe guess is that only 2 to 7% of babies that are created in a laboratory will be born alive. And anybody that has gone through this process understands that it is part and parcel of IVF to create children in a petri dish, see how many of those eggs fertilize, watch the fertilized eggs develop for 3 to 5 days, and then grade them. Even if they are, you know, if it has successfully fertilized, so they are embryos, they are little human lives, then you grade them. Maybe you've got 10 that fertilized. At 3 to 5 days, then you grade them, A, B, C, D. Very often, you will be advised to chuck the C and D embryos. Whatever ones are remaining, then you're gonna genetically screen them, right? Which ones are fit, which ones are unfit? And then, you know, 73% of clinics offer sex selection. Do you want boys or do you want girls? So maybe 10 are fertilized. Maybe you throw out 5. Maybe you determine that a few of them really don't look genetically fit and you end up with 3. Then you implant 1 and you freeze 2. That one fails because IVF pregnancies are typically high risk. You transfer another one. That one twins. And then you realize, wait a second, an IVF pregnancy is high risk. A twin pregnancy is high risk. You're also past, you know, your ideal childbearing years. Maybe you're 45 or 46, and you're advised to selectively reduce, that is abort, between 12 and 20 weeks. And then you're now, you know, you've, thank God, have a baby. Now, you know, once that child is at the point where they're in kindergarten and you finally have time to relax, now you're 50. And what do you do with that surplus embryo that's in the freezer? Well, now you don't know what to do, right? So you had 10 viable children. You weeded out 8 of them. You aborted one of them. And one of them is still in a freezer somewhere. That's pretty typical of kind of how the numbers shake out with IVF. That even though we've got about 90,000 children that are born each year through IVF in this country, there's probably 1.3 to 1.6 that are manufactured that will never see the light of day.
So given that number you just gave us, is there any way to salvage the technology and make it okay?
Well, let's talk a little bit about, so I just mentioned that's the biggest risk, the first risk that, you know, lab-made babies are subjected to. But the other one is when you're making a baby in a laboratory, it's just as easy to use somebody else's egg or somebody else's sperm than the mother or father's sperm. And so we have a huge number of children. Again, we don't know exactly, but anywhere from 30 to 60,000 a year who are losing their mother or father or both through the process of IVF. So can you salvage the technology? Well, it depends on what you mean by salvage. I mean, there's nothing to salvage if you're looking at it from the adult's perspective. The adults are getting what they want.
Right.
But if you believe that children have a right to life and a right to their mother and father, then you have to use IVF in a way that doesn't destroy any embryonic children and doesn't sever any of them from their biological mother and father. And that's kind of the scenario that most Christians think of. They're like, well, yeah, obviously, that's what I want to do. I just wanted to use, you know, my egg and my husband's sperm. I'm like, okay, that's fine. Maybe you're not going to violate a child's right to their mother and father through this. But if you want to go into this with a pro-life ethic, this is what it looks like. You only create the number of embryos that you intend to immediately implant without any grading or screening or sex selection or viability testing. You implant all of them. You carry every single one of them to term, even if they twin or triple. So you're looking at significantly high-risk pregnancies. And you don't freeze any of them. Now, people do not follow that path for two reasons. Number one, it is so cost prohibitive, hardly anybody can afford it. It costs a lot of money to make babies in a laboratory. So better to make 20 if possible than just 2. Okay, so number one, most people don't have the money to do it. Number two, you will fight your own fertility doctor if you try to conduct IVF in this way. Because one of the few things that fertility clinics do have to report is their live birth rates. Okay, now that's not how many lab-made babies are born. That's how many babies they implant that are born. And they guard those and protect those live birth rate numbers with their life. And if you walk into their clinic and say, I want to use subpar embryos, I don't want to selectively reduce, which might put the whole pregnancy at risk, I don't want to screen out undesirables, your fertility clinic is probably going to advise you against it because it's bad for you and it might lower your success rate. So you can try to do this pro-life approach, but you'll be doing it alone.
Yeah. Let's talk about embryo adoption. Is that a redemptive solution to all of these frozen embryos? Does it create a market? All of this is just so complicated and hard to sort through as believers, especially.
Yeah, we've got a really big crisis on our hands. I think that the most often cited estimate for the number of frozen children in this country is 1.5, but the truth is we have no idea. It could be as high as 10 million embryos on ice in this country. So we've got a humanitarian crisis if you believe that children are people from the moment of conception. A huge percentage of those children have been abandoned. The parents aren't paying the storage fee anymore. They are not responding to their emails. They are not able to contact the parents. And so you have frozen orphanages scattered all across this country. So what do you do for the children that have been forsaken and forgotten? Well, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, which is the authority on reproductive technology, says the options are thaw and discard, or donate to research, or donate to another couple as if it's a leftover couch. Mm-hmm. So if the children are genuinely forsaken, the only child honoring option is embryo adoption, not embryo donation, embryo adoption, where the intended parents do what you do in a traditional adoption. You work to keep sibling groups together. You try to have a known adoption, an open adoption with a relationship with the birth parents, the genetic parents, where possible. And the adoptive parents are screened, just like traditional adoptive parents are. However, that is not a solution to the massive number of children that are frozen right now. And I'll tell you why. It is because it is not the responsibility of unrelated adults, and it is not a perfect solution for the child for them to be embryo adopted. Mm-hmm. And I often talk about how this is actually really similar to adoption in the traditional sense. When a woman has an unplanned pregnancy, the solution is not adoption. Mm-hmm. The solution is parenting. What does it look like for that child's rights and needs to be met? It means that in the unplanned pregnancy, both the father and the mother conform their lives to the rights of the child so that the child doesn't have to lose their life or lose their mother or father to be brought into the world. So in that situation of an unplanned pregnancy, adults do hard things so children don't have to. That's what you do in an unplanned pregnancy. What do you do in a very planned pregnancy where you've created a bunch of surplus embryos? Well, the solution, again, is not adoption. It's the same solution as the unplanned pregnancy. The solution is parenting. Mm-hmm. The people who made the baby raised the baby. And maybe that means that you have more children than you wanted, or you have to buy a big Amazon-style van, or your parents need to move in with you so that you have a little bit of babysitter help. But your mistake of creating surplus children should not fall on the tiny shoulders of the babies that are in frozen storage. You need to do the hard thing. Embryo adoption is the right solution in that rare case where the adults cannot or will not bring those children into existence, but it by no means solves the overall problem of the massive surplus embryos that we have, and it does not even solve the problem for the children being adopted. Those children are going to struggle with some pretty dystopic existential questions that parents are going to need to be prepared to answer.
Well, on the subject of adoption, and you talk about how it's not, I think I understand what you mean when you say it's not the solution for an unplanned pregnancy. But what do you think about the difference between these two sentences? You have said a child has a right to be with their mother and father, as opposed to a child has the right to be with a mother and father. What's the difference and does that fire, that difference get you fired up?
It's a really important distinction, and I'm glad you brought it up. A lot of people on the right say children have a right to a mother and father. And that's a very safe way of stating it. Because if we said children have a right to their mother and father, that means that we might step on the toes of stepfamilies or adoptive mm-hmm. parents. But the truth is, when you're looking at things from a natural law perspective, and natural law is a philosophy of discovering moral universals based on looking at the natural world, it's a whole school of academic study. And when you look at natural law, you see that children don't have a right to generic man and woman. They have a right to their mother and father. They have a right to the two people responsible for their existence. Those two people are statistically the safest, most connected to, most invested in, and most protective of them. And the data is unquestioningly clear on that. Those two adults provide children with something that they crave, and that is their biological identity. Mm-hmm. It is very hard for children to answer the question, who am I, if they can't answer the question, whose am I? Mm-hmm. And those two adults, when children are raised by them, will always provide the perfect balance of maternal and paternal love that maximizes child development. So children don't have a right to a mother and father. They have a right to their mother and father. And if they lose that mother or father to tragedy, because the parents can't or won't raise them, then those children, nobody has a right to adopt those children. Children have a right to be adopted. In the world of adoption, and I say this as the former assistant director of the largest Chinese adoption agency in the world and an adoptive mother myself, nobody has a right to a child that's not biologically theirs. When adoption is done right, you're not there to give every adult who wants a kid a baby. You are there to provide a home for every child who has lost their mother and father. And whenever possible, the child deserves to be raised in a home that most closely replicates what it is that they've lost.
I'm glad you said you're an adoptive parent, because, I mean, you're not anti-adoption. You're just saying being with the biological mother and father is the ideal. But when that cannot happen, adoption's okay. I mean, adoption is a solution.
Yeah, adoption is a just society's response to children who have lost their parents, but it does not fix everything. I cannot fully compensate for everything that my child has lost. And even though adoptees, even if they are adopted at birth, adoptees on the whole are raised by parents who are wealthier, better educated, and who statistically have more stable marriages than the average family. And yet, adoptees disproportionately struggle with externalizing disorders. They struggle academically. They're more likely to struggle with substance abuse. It seems that there is something pretty critical about interrupting, especially that maternal bond, right, at the moment of birth, that hinders children in the future. Is it insurmountable? No, it's not. But one of the reasons why we've seen a drastic shift in adoption practice over the last 50 years is exactly because we have recognized. So there was sort of an era where adoption kind of hit the scene in the United States, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where it was called the baby scoop era, where a lot of young unmarried women, you know, thank you, sexual revolution, were having a lot of unwed babies, but there was still a stigma on single motherhood. So you would send these mothers away to mothers' homes, and they would visit their aunt and uncle for the summer. They would go, they would have the baby, they would come back, and nobody would ever knew. These babies would be adopted to, you know, white mothers giving birth to white babies who would be adopted by white adoptive parents, and supposedly it was no big deal and nobody was ever going to know. And those kids struggled, and the mothers struggled too. But in that era, it was largely closed adoptions, where there was no identifying information about, no relationship with, no connection to the child's first family. But today in the United States, in our adoption system, do you guys want to venture a guess what percentage of adoptions are closed adoptions?
It's a lot lower, isn't it?
20%.
Good guess, Scott. Marcy, you want to throw your hat in the ring?
15.
It's 5.
Wow.
So it's almost unheard of to have a closed adoption in the United States. Mm. And that's because, obviously, social workers have recognized that children have lost the bond with their birth mother. But they've recognized that whenever possible, children benefit from as many connections with their first family in terms of identity formation. And so the more contact they have, the better it is for the child's development. They have questions. Who are my parents? Do they look like me? Why did they give me away? Am I like them somehow? That children fare best when they have as much contact with their first family as is safe and possible, even if they can't be raised by them. And so even the adoption world and the adoption lessons that we have learned speak to the importance of the natural right children have to their mother and father. So I'm not anti-adoption. I understand it as a redemptive vehicle when it's properly understood. But we cannot confuse the redeeming aspect of adoption, or even the empathy or the sympathy or the desire to protect the feelings of adoptive parents or adopted children in our world by saying it doesn't matter. It does. And adoptive parents, and especially adopted children, are probably going to be the first to tell you that. Mm-hmm.
Do you think in a situation of a woman facing an unplanned pregnancy, maybe she's young, not even really able to support herself, is it better? It seems like it would still be better for her to try to keep her baby and mother and find the support that she needs versus giving her child a mother and a father situation. Would you agree with that? Even if there's not like a father in the home, I know that's a tough situation that people have to kind of wrestle through.
Well, either way you go, the child's going to experience loss, mm-hmm. right? A child being raised by a single mother will hunger for a father and long to be loved by a man. And we have the statistics on children raised by single mothers, that girls raised by single mothers predictably, are much more likely to experiment sexually early. They hit puberty a year earlier than their counterparts raised by their father. So they've got the combination of sort of an early reproductive season and a father hunger that makes them much more vulnerable to the attention of bad men and becoming a single mother themselves. boys that are raised by a single mother are almost predictably fall into, not predictably, but it is much more likely they will fall into a life of crime. Brad Wilcox at the Institute for Family Studies saw that children, boys who grew up without a dad, are more likely to go to prison than graduate from college. There are very serious risks to growing up without a dad. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, losing your birth mother, growing up apart from her, does seem to inflict a primal wound on children that makes it harder for them to thrive. So if that young girl wants to parent and keep her baby, then it is the responsibility of her parents, her extended family, her church family to throw themselves behind her and support her while she raises that baby. And even more so, to pressure the guy to reform himself so she's not doing it alone. That is the scenario where the kid loses nothing. So it's really, there's a lot of variables there. Either way, the child is going to struggle in some way statistically. And again, it's not insurmountable, but it doesn't do anybody any favors to pretend like either of these fixes it all. It doesn't.
When you look at the divorce rate in our country, it seems to be declining slowly but surely. Why and how do we keep that going?
Okay, the divorce rate is declining, but it's because people aren't getting married. So it's a big problem, okay? Yeah. So more people are choosing to shack up than get married. And so there's not as
you
many-
You couldn't let me enjoy that just for 2 seconds. You had to dose of reality.
Well, it's tough because, you know, the people that are at the marrying age, like the top of Gen Z, lots of millennials and the bottom part of Gen X, I mean, we all grew up in the divorce epidemic, you know, like where we saw our mother and fathers take off, not because there was abuse or adultery or abandonment or addiction, but because your mom found herself or your dad just fell out of love or they just kind of amicably said, it's not really working for us anymore. You know, I just kind of feel like it's time to move on. And it's interesting because children who have parents that divorce after a high conflict marriage do experience some relief when the marriage ends, because they're like, okay, well, at least I'm not in a place where the plates are being thrown across the kitchen anymore. The kids who suffer the most from divorce is the around 70% of kids whose parents had a low conflict marriage and just decided it was time to move on. Because what did those kids learn? They learned that anybody can leave you for any reason at any time. You'll never see it coming.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can do about it. Mm-hmm. So that generation learned cohabitation, that's safe. Marriage, that's risky. Now the problem is cohabitation is not safe, at least not for women, and certainly not for the children that often result in those cohabiting relationships. There is something distinctly different between marriage and cohabitation, even if it's the child's own biological parents, that children who are raised by their cohabiting but unmarried biological mother and father, they're about 3 times more likely to be abused, 4 times more likely to abuse substances, and 4 times more likely to live in poverty. Marriage is the great dividing line between kids who thrive and kids who don't. And so we have, in essence, like discipled a whole generation of people to avoid marriage. Now, interestingly, again, Brad Wilcox does some really good research on who is it who is forming marriages that are surviving. It tends to be college educated. It tends to be immigrants who are importing a culture that highly values marriage. And another group that does tend to thrive is the ones who survived family breakdown and decided their children were never gonna live through it. Mm-hmm. So if you experience family breakdown like divorce or were raised by a single mother, that does significantly damage the likelihood that you're gonna be able to form and maintain your own relationships. But if you go into it and say, my parents taught me what I will never do, and you mean it, those people tend to form successful marriages
as well. I've seen that. I've seen a few, especially women. I can think of a few women in my life. My mother-in-law is one who came from a household like that and says, we're never going to go through that. My kids will never experience that. And was committed. Yeah, no, I can absolutely see. I think, Marcy, I set myself up because I asked her about the divorce rate and I asked her why.
Yeah.
And she told me why.
Yeah. I have a question. I know we're probably wrapping up soon. I'm thinking about getting back to the pro-life movement and how we talk about things. A recent kind of cultural example I'm curious your thoughts on, and I apologize because I don't remember her name and I feel bad about that, but recently she came out and said, I am the mother of Elon Musk's, you know, most recent child. And as I was watching people chiming in on X, I just noticed all these prominent pro-life voices congratulating her and celebrating this life. And it feels like we've kind of gotten ourselves in a bind a little bit where, yes, we want to celebrate life, but we need to take a look at, again, how that life is being created and what, you know, Elon's only really fathering so many of those children. But I'm curious your thoughts on that. And is that something that the pro-life movement needs to sit out? Do we need, you know, what should our message and our thinking be on things like that?
I wrote an entire article on that very phenomenon that you're mentioning. It's called The Cost of Conservative Hypocrisy, and you can read it at World Magazine's in their opinion section. But I think that you're putting your finger on something that really matters. I challenged a few of them, and they said, well, we're not congratulating the circumstances. We're congratulating that a new life was born. And I'm like, really? Well, did you congratulate Lily Phillips, the OnlyFans girl, when she faked a pregnancy a couple days after that, you know, after she slept with 1,000 men in 24, why didn't you congratulate her if it's just about creating a new life? Why didn't you congratulate Pete Buttigieg and his partner when they had two children, you know, holding them in the hospital? Was it just you didn't, you condemned it. Mm-hmm. And so for me, a lot of it is conservative hypocrisy. That it looks like we're going to congratulate this person if they're in our own political camp, but we're going to critique if they're not. So either the baby is always good, which they are, or you need to be a little more consistent with your messaging. And here's the importance. This is why I think it's so important. We are seeing the long prayed for and absolutely stunning transformation of the religious and political appetites of Generation Z. Especially young men are so much more traditional and religious than any of the generations before them. And they are desperately looking for bold, courageous, clear, and consistent people to follow. And they will, like, they are looking for somebody to say, I'm going to take a principled stance. Even if it means I might lose some friends, even if it means I have to critique my political allies. They, like all young people, are hungry for a great calling and a great task, but they can't do it simply by speaking into the abstract. They have to see it embodied by real leaders. I pray that some of those people are their own fathers, definitely their own pastors. But there is such fertile soil for influencers who will say, I am going to take a consistently, I would argue, pro-child stance. And my allegiance is going to be for the kids. I'll tell you what, that is how you're going to inspire transformation in an entire generation and have it be a little bit more than just kind of political fad. You will be able to cultivate and really develop an entire generation whose roots, biblical roots, conservative groups, pro-child roots go deep, deep down to the point where that tree is going to blow and it's not going to be susceptible to the changing political winds.
I think you just illustrated for us the difference between pro-life and pro-child. I can tell that's where your passion is.
Well, and I often talk about how marriage and family is children's rights 2.0. I really think that pro-life is children's rights 1.0. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to be child-centric. The right to life is the primary fundamental right. Nothing else matters if you can't do pro-life. But there is more to that. I want to defend children's rights in the womb, but we have to defend children's rights outside of the womb. The same tactics and approach that work to fight abortion is the same tactics and approach that are going to work to fight family redefinition. Protecting a child's right to life ensures their survival. Protecting children's right to their mother and father ensures their thriving. And so, like, these two things go hand in hand. To me, it is a pro-child world, a pro-child ethic. And I actually have written that it goes far beyond life and family. It goes into really every area of culture war. Every culture war issue ultimately comes down to, are you going to protect children or are you going to victimize them? Whether you're looking at drag queen story hour or age verification laws for pornography or transing the gender confused child, every cultural issue comes down to, are you going to protect children and their fundamental rights to life, to their mother and father, to innocence, to an intact, unmedicalized body, or are you going to victimize them? You know, to me, it's the very clear black and white issue.
Katie's got a lot of material. She writes a lot, as you have mentioned. And then before us, that you've got a great, robust social media presence, so lots of different videos. And there at the very end of your comments, you brought up about three other topics we could talk about. And so we'll have to have a part two with you. This has been fascinating. You know, I told you before we started recording that, especially on the IVF issue, you know, I just can't get there in terms of it just firing me up. You made a dent in that today.
Did I kindle anything? Was there a spark?
Well, you know, your line about how big fertility has killed more than Planned Parenthood. You know, and it's, you know, let me be clear.
Possibly by a magnitude of four or more.
And it's not that I disagree. It's not that. It's just, I think, and I don't think I'm alone in the pro-life movement. It just doesn't fire me up like, you know, if you talk about, you know, the coercion and the violence done to the baby, all the other things we always talk about as a pro-life movement, that really gets me angry and my blood boiling. IVF hasn't done that, but something tells me if I spent a little more time with you, that would probably change.
Yeah, well, we've got a lot of things that my guests would fill in some of the blanks.
Yeah.
Because that same fire that you have to fight for children who are facing abortion, that fire, you know, belongs in all these other places where children are being victimized. And it really is a pro-child ethic that is driving you. And you know, it's needed in so many different arenas.
Thenbeforeus.com, you need to check it out if you want to learn more on all the socials as well. Katie, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good to be with you guys.